younger. You know, he's almost 10 years younger, so he would look younger to you. That fits. And he was 27. Okay, so we're reading along here.
By that I mean it's like he had a baby face compared to most.
Right. Okay, so Wes comes aboard to help with the photo end of printing. Our job was not only to print art posters and accept interesting jobs, but also to make a living and pay for the new equipment we had purchased that did every kind of printing. Somehow we made a living. For about a year, we worked hard and kept late hours. Wes and Eva decided to get married. Wes designed his own wedding invitation. It was based on what he saw the day he took the LSD.
Hmm.
I think this was one of the first works of psychedelic art in San Francisco. Later, we designed and printed the first rock posters for the Fillmore Dance Concerts in 1966. Wes suddenly began to be famous. His art was in demand. He had a new career. So the wedding invitation was based on the LSD that Bob Carr gave him. So Bob Carr was, again, instrumental in the iconography of psychedelic art.
Mm-hmm. Now, the experience I had with Wes Wilson, I think, was in 63 or 64.
Okay.
And what happened particularly...
You place this, you're now living in Seattle, and you go back down to San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm on vacation. Well, up in Seattle, I had done favors for a guy who happened to be the campaign manager for a coroner who was getting elected. And at one point, this guy told me, he said, well, would you like to have a coroner's card? I said, what in the world would I want one of those? He says, if you have that in your wallet and you get stopped, if you have it, it'll make a difference. And I said, well, okay. He says, well, fill out this form. And so I did. And about a week later, he told me to drop over by his place. And when I went over, I thought he was just going to hand me a card. What he did is that an envelope that came out of it slipped this gorgeous badge that said coroner on it. And then for where the numbers were supposed to be, it was my initials, D-E-W. And I said, what? He says, yeah, just put that inside your wallet with the card. Put the card in the wallet and attach this on the inside face of your wallet, and you just flip it open, and so anyway, I did that. I felt like it was a gag. I showed it to a few people. Well, anyway, at Bob and Connie's, we were on acid.
That's up in Seattle. Are you aware of, is that by the summer of 63 when you're aware of Doobie channeling at that point?
I don't know.
Because you join, once you hear this channeling in summer of 63, you join the group, right?
Loosely, for a while.
You go to Hazelwood.
Yeah, I went to a meeting or two, and then it was not long before they got the Highland Hall, and I was in, I got a suite there in the 40-room mansion. And so, anyway, the thing back to San Francisco and Wes Wilson at Bob and Connie's in 1963 or 64, when we dropped acid.
Wes too? Wes also?
Yes, Wes was on acid. And I remember that as well as a couple of funny little stories that happened during the session first.
This would not be Wes's first time. Are you sure of that?
I don't know.
You might have been there for that first acid trip.
I don't know.
Okay.
But I do know this, that at one point, I had shown the shield, the badge, to Bob. And at one point, Bob says, oh, I got something for you to see, Wes. He says, David, show him. I said, what do you mean? He says, you know. I said, oh, yeah. So I flipped open the badge and Wes just about flew through the ceiling. He thought I was a Nazi that had come to arrest him in the middle of this session. And then finally we got him convinced that no. And then when he heard the story of it, he had to know the particulars. Who is this guy and how did it happen and all the rest of it before we could settle him down.
But the thing is, LSD wasn't illegal, but people were paranoid about it anyways.
Well, it was categorized as a dangerous drug, and it was in October 66, that dangerous drugs got an illegal status.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
A status which meant that it had to be triplicate prescription, where a doctor on any dangerous drug, if the doctor prescribes it, the pharmacist fills it, and the third copy goes to the federal government. You see what I mean?
Well, that's for the dangerous drug?
Any, you know, there's all kinds of dangerous drugs.
Right. Okay, but, when did LSD get categorized as a dangerous drug?
Well, I had something to do with that, because when we filled out the forms of sorts
for Al Rock, for Captain Al Hubbard,
in the earliest days, I made a statement, a simple statement that got pushed all the way through, which I didn't really know about for a long time. But the statement I made is: this is not an upper, this is not a downer, but it is a dangerous drug. And so that was not in caps. And then pretty soon, right away, dangerous drugs in caps came out, and they started listing a lot of dangerous drugs. And then at a certain point, then the category came in, dangerous drugs have to have this triplicate thing. And believe me, if the federal government saw something coming in, they kept an eye on it, you know.
Yeah, and so that would be the late 50s.
That I wrote that?
You said it at the Center of Integration. This is not...
No, yeah, it would have been probably in the early part of 57.
Yeah,
when I first started working with it.
With Hubbard, and Hubbard with the
farms. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you're saying became a dangerous drug... Capital letters came out of with it by 58 or 59, right?
Well, I don't know. I think it started being used, but it, as far as the categorizing, I think it was a little bit later.
Okay, but the by 64, West is aware of this. 63, 64, and it could be busted as a dangerous drug, the kind of thing.
Not till 66.
Okay, so. So why? But we're talking about West being paranoid that you're a nut.
But he was paranoid because he'd been in jail before, and he saw a badge, and,
oh, okay.
And he thought it was a narc.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. So the thing is, the dangerous drug triplicate thing is before October 66.
I think it was at October.
October 66, LSD is banned. You can't use it.
Well, that's LSD.
What am I saying? I'm talking about LSD.
Well, it's banned except for those who had special programs.
Okay.
As I found out later, there were, let's see, in 1970, I know that there had been 40 different projects in the country that were operated by people, and they had the permission to do it. You know, it's like...
Okay, but what's the dangerous... Is the dangerous drug triplicate necessity before October 66 or after?
I thought it was October 66, but I don't know. That would be interesting to know, I suppose, as to when they started doing the dangerous drug triplicate. I only know that...
It was after you said it in 57.
Yeah, I know that in the summertime, or before October, when I went down to the Christian Murdy talks in...
October 66.
Yeah, that I had this opportunity to get 10 million doses of Owsley. And after thinking about it 3 to 5 minutes, I said no because of enormous energy. And then I was very grateful because in the matter of 2 or 3 months, it was banned. And I didn't, therefore I never got focused on. See, as I've told you before, I consider I've hidden right out in the open.
Yeah.
Always used my own name and everything else. But apparently I've come up to certain points and made a zigzag just before it would have been a hook for me. Many, 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 many times.
Right. Yeah. And
which
you
doesn't mean that I was crooked, but I just barely wasn't.
Right. And you're saying that... did you say that you were Christian Murray in October 66 and a couple months later was banned? No, we're saying it was banned a couple weeks later.
Somewhere in there.
After the Owsley offer.
Well, I don't know. I think it might have been as much as a month or so before going. I know that they asked me to be the key man, and I said no. But a few weeks later, they brought me 100 tablets. Each tablet turned out to have 16 hits. And I know I took some of that with me to California and took some when I was there at Krishnamurti, and he looked at me and said, "You don't take these things, you know."
Right.
There's
well, that
crowd, and he looks right at me.
That's October 66. That's
yeah.
Those meetings. So you were given the was it Owsley acid?
Yes.
You were given that before you went to see Krishnamurti, and then you
yes.
used it during Krishnamurti. What?
But the real kicker is I only took part of them with me and left them with Chris, and Chris took 40 hits in 40 days. In other words, I don't know of anybody who had ever taken that much. And later I told Monty West about it. And so he brought some concoction that was made at the UW. And he said, "This is very powerful. You only want to take a little tiny bit." So I did. And while I was on it, Chris says, "Well, can I have some?" I says, "Well, it's in that thing. But you have to take a very small amount." Well, he took a match, and that turned out to be 16 hits. And when we told Monty West, he says, "I've been wanting somebody to do that." And Chris said, "How dare you?"
But that is not the 40-day thing.
No.
Yeah,
no.
Okay.
That was back in 66.
Yeah, because that it brings in a little synchronicity. Walter Boer tells the famous story that he was given something in the fall of 66, and he, on one of the other interviews we have with him, he goes into the details. He doesn't know what it was, but it put him on a high or strange hallucinatory experience for 40 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, there was something out that came out that I avoided. I heard about it, but it was, oh, God, what was it? It was like PCP, but it was something else. But what it did is it put somebody on acid for a long time. The way it came to our attention, and I was living at Highland Hall, was that there was a doctor down in Oregon that the cops came and got him and brought him to a theater in Portland, and in the balcony of the theater was a dozen or more people that were on this stuff, and the cops couldn't get them off of it. And so what he did is he stayed with them, and it took him days and days and days to talk them down. And that's when whatever that, I don't remember what it was. I don't think it was PCP because it didn't ring a that was a different kind of a session thing.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Just looking, it says Is LSD illegal? Just looking up some facts. Yes, LSD is illegal. LSD is a Schedule 1 substance under the Controlled Substances Act. Schedule 1 drugs, which include heroin and MDMA, have a high potential for abuse and serve no legitimate medical purpose. So that's the mainstream thing.
They call it Controlled Substance Act, but see, the dangerous drugs came before.
Right.
And then they chose certain dangerous drugs to be called controlled substance.
Right. So the looking on the Wikipedia, they say that, I'm just getting the actual date. Okay, a second, moving down here quickly. Where does it say? LSD is, okay, legal status. I saw, prior to October 6th, 1966, LSD was available legally in the United States as an experimental psychiatric drug. So it's interesting that you may have gotten the Owsley stuff in September. And that means you may have been on acid, according to the date I'm saying, the end of September was when you asked the question of Krishnamurti that we talk about in the Paranoia magazine interview.
No, it was in October, because he wasn't speaking in September.
According to the dates our friend Mons found, yes. But in my diary entries, I have the end of September. But would you have taken the, in your memory, are you taking the Owsley acid after you were offered it and you're with Krishnamurti? After you were offered it.
Well, now, when it was first offered to me, the first time I took it was July the 4th. On July the 4th, because I took it. A friend arrived who had never taken it, always wanted to take it. And I told him I'd done it. He says, well, I'll take it. And then about 45 minutes later, I get a telephone call from Everett, from Chris, telling me that I had agreed to pick him up.
That's Everett. Why? That's where you live now. Why is he there 40 years ago?
His family.
Oh, he's from there? Or his family?
Yeah, that's
living?
That's the connection with Everett, is his family.
Oh, okay. So he calls and says, why didn't you pick him up?
Yeah, and so on acid, I drive this brand new Chevrolet, because I'm a sales manager for Courtesy Chevrolet at the time. And so I drive this up to get some gas, and the guy does our windshield, and this kid is sitting next to me and going out of his mind as the ballet that this guy is doing, and the guy's doing it almost as though we're high.
As though he was
a
high.
Performance that was unbelievable.
You mean you're saying it looked like the guy was doing it, who was himself? Is that what you're saying?
Well, or that he noticed we were, and he was before. Anyway, we leave there and get out on the freeway, and we're heading north on I-5, and I wave my arm to the right, and I say to Biff, I think it's not, no, that's another, no. Maybe his name was Biff, too, but anyway, that's the ape, but the chimp, but. No, so Pete Bittner.
Okay.
Pete. Anyway, there was a nickname for him. But anyway, I say to Beef, to Pete,
are you
off
talking
to
about
the
Cliff,
right.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about Cliff Bittner? Remember that name?
Yes.
You're talking about Cliff Bittner?
Cliff,
yeah, I met him. Yeah, go ahead.
He did.
Yeah, he's the guy. Okay, well, that's another story. But anyways, Cliff. Yes, you're with Cliff, and you what? You want to turn?
No, I'm on I-5, and I just waved my arm to the right, and I said, and I was one of the designers on the third phase of this North Gate, which was the first major shopping center in the world.
Yeah.
And that all that I did in relation to that was multiplied 28 times in 28 shopping centers all over the world. And I was the one who chose and wrote the specifications and designed the details and approved all the drawings.
But look,
when I was working for John Graham. But anyway,
Dave,
I'm saying,
here. Dave, the linguistic punning here, Northgate, we started off this session talking about gatekeepers. Captain Al Hubbard, or Captain A.M., yeah, Captain Al, even though his initials are A.M.,
yes.
Captain Albert, sometimes I go A.L. Hubbard, but no, Captain A.M. Hubbard, Al Hubbard, was the gatekeeper for LSD in the 50s and 60s. And he was in the Northwest, and that's the North Gate, and then you did the building, and you're on acid in 66 on Owsley, and you're pointing out the North Gate.
Anyway, as we continue...
You got the linguistic pun there, right?
Yes, I know, yeah. But as we continue, there's an on-ramp just ahead of us that the cop is coming up. And we're in the middle lane. It is at sunset. Now, at sunset, it was 70 miles an hour, except at sunset, it dropped to 60. And it was just becoming sunset. So I slowed down to exactly 60 and was coming along in this lane. And here was this cop car coming up parallel us. And they were right alongside us as we met, so to speak. And Pete was flipping because he didn't like cops. I knew it. And so I was talking to him. I said, all right, now one of the things that you find out is that any time, but particularly now that you're on acid, if you send out signals of rejection, cops pick it up right away.
Mm.
Because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for signals.
Yeah.
And I said, so... the thing for you to do is just to focus ahead and don't send any negative signals. And he says, you don't know how hard this is. I said, well, cool it for a little while. So anyway, I continued at 60 miles an hour. The cop dropped back a little, so it was kind of behind us. And pretty soon... we have nobody in front of us because all the fast ones have gone ahead. The ones that are dropping down to a lower speed are me and the ones behind me. And because the cop is going just a little bit slower, we start having a lot of space between us and the cops. And within about 10 or 15 minutes, we're probably 500 yards ahead, and I look in the rearview mirror, and there's nothing but cars behind me as far as you can see. There's no cars ahead of me. I look across the traffic on the other side. It's virtually solid, and this is July the 4th, the holiday,
<Yeah.
laughs> at sundown, and so we drive all the way to Everett. With nobody ahead of us and nobody behind us, and we're on acid. Oh, my Lord.
Well, the cops fell behind?
No, they were. It's almost as though they were blocking the cars from following us because they went slightly slower, and the ones behind wouldn't pass them. I mean, it was like they were our chaperones, or they just liked us. I don't know.
There was a parade. They're behind you during this whole period that you're the leading.
But they were far behind, you know, because I was continuing at 60 miles an hour, and they were continuing at 55. So they were, everybody behind us was slowly disappearing in the background. And before too long, there was nobody ahead of us and nobody behind us for 20, 30 miles.
Okay. Now, this, you say Pete. You mean Cliff Bittner, right?
Yes. Yes.
And he, was that when you first met him?
Oh, no.
Okay. But it was his first time on acid?
Yes.
Okay. So he had quite a trip that day.
Didn't we all?
Right. So that's July 4th. That's Owsley Acid, right?
Yes.
So... then somewhere in there you get offered, you know, in August, September, you get offered the dealership.
Well, no, I was offered that before they brought it to me. In other words, they offered that before July.
Okay.
And then they brought that around to me, and I took it on July the 4th. But now there's something important here I think I'm forgetting now. What in the heck was
The Krishnamurti thing is that you do use that acid in September, October.
Yes.
So it is. You see, that's the confusion. You said that was made illegal, a couple of months later. That makes sense if you were offered it in June.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I had it down in California and it was banned, we probably had some. Actually, Millett had part of it because I didn't have much money, and he said, well, that's all right. I'll take some of that. I'll use my credit cards. And so I said, okay. So the extra Owsley acid paid for my trip down to see Krishnamurti and back. Somewhat.
Okay.
But anyway, there was another thing about Owsley. Now, with the real Sandoz, the authentic Sandoz, there's an extra molecule compared to the other acid, the street acid, all the other acid that was made, except for Owsley. But that extra molecule made it 50 times stronger than street acid. This is the calibration that I was given, I think, by someone at Hollywood Hospital, but I don't know, because it was later. And anyway, the Owsley also had an extra molecule, but it was a different molecule that made it 50 times stronger than street acid.
And equal to the Sandoz.
50 yeah.
times greater.
But if you took both of them together and got both of these extra molecules, it was at least 250 times as strong as street acid, which really means that you could take far, far less and get far, far more.
Right.
And of course, I took very, very little of the various acids that were around. I think I did try some... here and there on good verification, but because I had access to Sandoz and Owsley, I mostly, out of all the other stuff was out, I think I probably had five or six sessions with other stuff, and there was names for them, but I'm not going to go into them now.
But you're saying you had the Sandoz, and you didn't have any Sandoz in the mid-60s. You had Owsley and others.
I didn't have any. Well, I think I got some of the blue pills he's talking about.
Yeah, Bob Carr.
Yeah, but I can't remember when.
But mainly you're getting other sources of acid in the mid-60s.
In the late 60s on, there were very, very, see, I was so integrated, shall we say, that I didn't have to take acid. It's like I was acid.
Right.
Does that sound pompous?
No, Salvador Dali said, I don't take drugs, I am drugs.
Uh-huh.
You refined it, or you're the archetype for what he's picked
yeah.
up later.
And of course, we had connections with him too, you know.
Yeah, through the that
Friends Roadshow. He became the sponsor of the Friends Roadshow and the celebration of energy and light by the clown troupe in Notre Dame Cathedral.
Yes, and that happens, it comes into your life, 74, they're there, 1974 at the August Affair.
Yeah, but they had been doing this in Paris in...
for years.
About 71.
Okay. Before we go back to the book, it just says here, prior to October 6, 66, LSD was available legally in the United States as an experimental psychiatric drug. LSD apostle in quotes, Al Hubbard, actively promoted the drug between the 50s and the 70s and introduced thousands of people to it.
And what? Excuse me, I got distracted here. Read that last line again, please.
Okay. LSD apostle Al Hubbard actively promoted the drug between the 50s and the 70s and introduced thousands of people to it. Well,
that's in Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
But that's the point. It comes out of northwest United States with you guys.
Well, the Canada.
Yeah, it comes out of Al Hubbard, but it becomes beginning. I don't know. He did it other places with small elites or.
Well, he did. He wasn't the thing that he stated to me when he came to see me was that they had tried to give it to other groups, but every time they did, it shattered the group.
Mm.
And then he was looking to see if this was a likely group to be. And I said, because I was the president, but it was like to me being a president was just like a name only,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And I said, well, now, and then that's when I brought in Bob and Connie and all the rest of the dialogue, even some which I was present, was through them and with the agreement with Hubbard that I would handle the sessions, because the way that I functioned in the sessions were so astounding to them that they wanted to see if, and of course, the way Bob and Connie handled the session, Bob didn't handle it very well to start with, so I think Elliot Craig told Hubbard, be sure that David handles it, and then because they were the officers of the thing, they managed everything else and then gradually got involved in the therapy sessions too.
So the idea that Hubbard would not distribute it on the level Leary popularized, and he would do it with special groups, and he felt he could control it, but it did leak out when he gave you guys all that acid. Or Robert says he got it from Sandoz directly, but anyway.
Well, we got it before any of those others got it.
That's right. And then
because we were the format by which they decided that it was possible. Before that, it wasn't possible. In other words, the techniques they were using didn't work. The techniques we were using that they learned about worked and was the rule by which these other people did it. And ultimately, the 12 principles that I personally, and here I am putting my big eye up there, was the instigator in that time life issue on drugs in 1966. They don't credit anybody with it. They just say, this is the way you do it. And of course, the publisher and his wife were wild about LSD. Long before that. They were early.
Yeah, and Henry Luce.
Yeah, and Claire Booth Luce, yes. They were very much into it, but I don't know what date. I'm sure that most of the key things that happened were after I gave the clues that worked to Hubbard.
Right.
And then the Center of Integration became involved. I was just the therapist, and the significance of the control of the office and etc. were in the hands of Bob and Connie, and they very rarely asked me about any of that. And they did a lot of things that didn't include me then, too, but I didn't care.
But it's the you guys getting the acid and Doobie getting that a big amount, and then it's stolen by Ed Young. That is the beginning in 60, 61, 62 when it starts spreading
well,
out.
Well, the thing is, the stuff that Doobie had, I think, was stolen from Hubbard.
Yes.
First, and I don't know how Doobie got so much. There's a lack in there, whether it's the same stuff or what, you know, I don't know. And then the attempt to use it at the Winter Garden with Bob and Connie and having that set up, and that didn't come off. And when Ed Young heard that they were going to do that without including him in, he exploded, destroyed the suite in the hotel, took off with the Jaguar and the drugs, and then
who knows where it went then?
Well, I'm sure that Doobie still had it. And yeah, I think they both still had it for years.
Well, you said, Ed, did they get back together, Ed Stone?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay.
Doobie came up, and it wasn't very long before he...
But that's the beginning of the radiation, the emanation of LSD on the street level, is coming through your group, and it was controlled at first, but then it got out of hand, and then later, Owsley and these other people come in, and that guy Hollingshead, whatever his name is, Michael Hollingshead, from England. But the thing is that this is what it says. It says LSD apostle Al Hubbard actively promoted the drug between the 50s and 70s and introduced thousands of people to it. And that is... you are an extension of that. Then it says the U.S. federal government classified it as a Schedule One drug according to the Controlled Substances Act of 1970. So that's the federal level. October 6, 66, may be just in California, though I'm not sure. Okay.
Uh-huh. Quite possible.
What? Beg your pardon?
Quite possible.
What is?
Now, see, one of the things that I need to mention here that. My proclivity was to see information, absorb it, and didn't always remember where I got the information. That goes for all kinds of books and stuff. So when I come up against scholastic people and people who are social animals that want to know the connection of people, see, I remember the events and not necessarily the source. By name, including people. It's just like when I've had experiences with various people or connections that I come up with this information. But there's a lot that is virtually hidden, and unless I went under deep hypnosis and questioning, those things would never come up. And I won't do that because what's the point? I mean, it's pointless to me. Somebody else may think so, but that's thought, and I stay away from it.
Okay, so the what are the 12 principles you came up with?
I don't remember exactly. I remember they're there, and I probably expound them various times without enumerating them. So if you want to know that, you would go to that Time Life thing on drugs and the part on LSD and read the list of 12 points.
Well, how would that have gotten to them?
I don't know, but the thing is, the thing I was thrilled about, as I have been thrilled about things other times, is that when something I have given out is received so totally that when it goes through many generations of communication, it is still the same thing. Mm. This is amazing. If you know anything about how rare that is.
Yeah.
But I could look at it, and it was like a flash of exactly. And I was kind of proud of it, but also there were times I thought, gee... It kind of would have been nice to get some credit.
Yeah.
But then I realized by not getting credit, I didn't get focused on, so I was able to hide right out in the open all this time. And see, that was, when that occurred, when that publication occurred in 66, I guess I was about 38?
Yep, 38.
All right, and I'm 80 years old now. See how much freedom I've had?
Yeah.
From trouble?
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of trouble you haven't heard about. But from my standpoint of my consciousness moving through and ability to do things, I think it's pretty fantastic, pretty amazing.
Yep, I agree. So just a little side thing before I go back to the book. We're mentioning Henry and Claire Booth Luce. McLuhan was a good friend of at least Claire. Maybe Henry was dead by then, but he would
really.
And he would visit her mansion, whatever she had here in Hawaii.
Yeah, I know. I've been there. I didn't do much, but see, I was, when I was a disc jockey over there, somebody took me out to her place, and we walked around and looked at the place, and
right, so McLuhan visited her probably in the 60s, spent time at her estate.
Well, with me, it would have been 1948.
Yeah, 49. Okay, so the what it says here, this is we're coming to the end of a phase. This is the end of Bob's world that led into the psychedelic fad or fashion or movement. He says he's talking about Wes, you know, makes the wedding invitation, and it's based on the LSD he took with Robert Carr. And so Robert says, I think this was one of the first works of psychedelic art in San Francisco. Later, we designed and printed the first rock posters for the Fillmore dance concerts in 66. Wes suddenly began to be famous. His art was in demand. He had a new career. But then Bob says, some months before this, Connie and I had received a letter from a lawyer in Seattle telling us that we were included in the will of, can you name the person who gave them this money? Named in the will?
Offhand, I can't. I know that it happened.
Yeah.
Does it give a name?
Yeah, Alice Taylor.
Alice Taylor, I know the name, and I kind of remember her.
Because it says who had once lived at the center, so you probably knew her.
Okay, Alice at the center. Okay,
Alice.
Yeah, yeah. I remember. I think she had the room that was adjacent to theirs. There was Rose, who was the housekeeper, had the middle room, and then I had the room on the other end, and then there was Glenn Hallam had a room, or unless it was before, in between that she had the room where Glenn Hallam had once had it. I can't remember for sure, but okay.
So they get a letter a couple months before the rock poster world takes off with Wes, and they're working with Wes. So they received a letter from a lawyer. Now the lawyer contacted. So they had got the letter a few months before. Now, in the spring of 66, the lawyer contacted us again and told us that probate was completed and he was ready to disperse the assets from her estate. It was a windfall for us both. We decided to close up our house, sell everything, and travel abroad. And he sold the printing business. We could work. I sold the printing business. It's a misprint here, but he has we, but I think he means Wes. Wes could work out of his house doing his now well-known art. We took a plane to Seattle and bought 2 tickets to Europe. This was a dream come true, as we both were ready for a new adventure. Krishnamurti was going to speak in Sane in Switzerland. That's
Yeah. Okay.
And we both thought that we would stay in Europe, travel about, and take in the talk.
Did it say Vivian went over there, too?
No, it's just him and Connie.
Well, Vivian is Connie's sister, and I think she went over there, too.
But are they bumping? Well, I think she is over there, but they bump into her someplace. I think that comes up, but she didn't go with them. She went on her own trip.
Uh-huh.
With, I think, Vivian.
Who? Isabel.
Yes, I think the two of them. So they leave Seattle in April 66, he says, and when we arrived in London, there was still snow on the ground. We only spent a couple of days sightseeing and flew into Amsterdam. After more sightseeing, we visited my friend Rick Dahlstrom, whom I had known in Portland. You remember that name, Rick Dahlstrom?
Vaguely.
Okay, he had married a Swedish girl and was living in Stockholm. The city was interesting, but we spent most of our time with Rick. His wife was away visiting relatives. Rick was bored living in Sweden and said he wanted to move back to the USA and live in San Francisco. His son, who was about 8 years old, just loved the Rolling Stones. We smoked some pot that night, we smoked some pot that we had bought in Amsterdam, and Rick was amazed.
Just a minute. Okay.
They smoked the pot they bought in Amsterdam, and Rick was amazed at how liberating its effect was. We all had a trippy night listening to his son's music. After a few days, we took a boat and an overnight train to Germany. The next morning, we boarded a train to Milan. We stayed there just one night, then off we went to Spain. Now, they spend a lot of time in Spain, and they're heading towards to see Krishnamurti in July. Okay, so this is going to be the dramatic time when he gets to spend time with Krishnamurti in India.
And this is in July of 66.
Yes.
Which is before he comes to Ojai. Okay.
Yes, it's before he comes. He sees Krishnamurti in July, and then Krishnamurti invites him to the Rishi Valley in November, December, and then they get to spend a lot of time.
Yeah, but in the meantime, Krishnamurti comes and speaks at Ojai.
Where you asked.
And then
question.
He goes to Rishi Valley, and then they meet him
there.
There.
Okay, we will do that in the next session, but I just wanted to say there was something about this. This is the period, April 66, when they're heading out, and do you remember talking to them about getting the money and leaving? Were you interacting?
Yeah, well, the thing I remember is that I can't remember the reason, but the number of 19, which I think had to do with Baha'i.
Yeah.
So that when she split up her fortune and gave it, she gave it in 19ths. Now, whether she gave Connie 1/19th and Bob 2/19ths, or Connie 2 and Bob 3/19ths, something like that. She gave more to Bob than she gave to Connie, but they were increments of 19ths of her fortune, according to probably Baha'i.
Which he was a member of, you mean?
Probably.
Okay, so the...
Because, you see, Center of Integration had all these different people that would come in from different things. And,
yeah.
And, there were theosophists and, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so the thing is, though, they took a plane to Seattle and bought two tickets to Europe. Do you think you saw them in that period?
I don't remember. What I do think is that I might have seen them, and they told what they were doing, and then they were going to travel. I don't remember any particular event of where, what, or, but I do know that I knew
what had happened, and they were pretty lucky.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
It was almost like getting paid for all the underground work he'd done in the 50s and 60s, you know?
Yes, I don't even know how much it was. I do know that they were able to go and spend quite some time in India, and about the time that they were going to have to leave because of money, I think they even asked for help from some people in the States for additional money to stay different times.
Yeah, he talks about some of that, but the thing is, they're away for a year. They don't come back till March 67.
Yeah, but the really effective thing that happened is that one time there was noises on the street, and Connie went to the balcony to see what it was, and across the way was a guy on another balcony, and they were talking about what was going on in the street. Anyway, they got acquainted enough that they got together, and it turned out that he was one of the major tea plantation owners of Ceylon.
Yes, he goes into that.
All right.
You're talking about when they're in India.
Yes.
Okay, so we need to wrap this up, but I want to just say what's interesting, when I was talking to Bob Carr last night, or the night before, I can't remember, I told him the concept of Rai, which he'd never heard of. He didn't know anything about this Rai nonsense, right? And, He writes it down, and I'm saying it's R-H-Y-E. He goes, what? R-H-Y? What? Y-H? So it was really hard for him to write down the Y-E. R-H, it was like totally new, strange language. But what's it for me, to relate it to you, is that it's in this period of April 66 and 66 that Doobie withdraws from Seattle or Portland, Olympia. Where was he at that point? Yeah, he was.
Let's see. Doobie?
Yeah, Doobie is, where's the Organization of Awareness in 66? Where is it? Not in Hazel?
Oh, he moves down to, let's see, I think there's a move. No.
There's
Hazel.
Let's
see, the people in Olympia are trying to move him down there.
And he's at Hazelwood, or is he moved beyond Hazelwood?
Well, from Hazelwood, it went to Organization of Awareness in a new corporation.
And where was that? What was the address?
That was in Highland Hall. It was in Seattle.
Okay, Highland Hall in Seattle. And Olympia.
But then there was a powerful group of people in Olympia and Portland and et cetera. And so when he started wanting, actually he wanted to buy the Highland Hall, and he had a couple of chances, and it was a bargain, but it didn't come off, so he decided he wasn't going to stay there. I don't know the date on that, because I had moved out in early 66, because he asked me to. I mean, I had confronted him in November about him going into trance and not being true.
November 65, right.
Yeah, and...
But anyways, this, we're just getting the general points. We'll go into it later.
So at any rate, they wanted to move the headquarters to Olympia. And so what Doobie did, I don't know, but he one-upped on them and moved to Hawaii and tried to pull it over there, and the ones in Olympia blocked him and blocked him. And so he got a lot of heavy energy, etc. So it's almost as though when he went to Hawaii, he would have had to almost start over again. But he was living on the 23rd floor of the Ilokai Hotel, which was a luxury hotel.
In Honolulu?
In Honolulu. And anyway, that's where he died.
Right. So he is Winston Turnbow a strong force in Olympia around this group resisting him?
Right. But yeah, he wasn't the only one.
Okay.
There was a whole bunch of them that were not going to let him move it to Hawaii.
Can you name a couple of names? Is Geraldine Morris one of them?
Yes.
A couple other names? Geraldine Morris and that you can think of.
Let's see. David and, let's see, what was their last name? A husband and wife team. There was another husband and wife team, and their name was... started with a B.
Where was the quote mafia family? Were they involved at that point?
Well, let's see.
That was Patricia or something, or Pat?
Pat. Well, she might have been involved a little. She was in Portland. It wasn't until after I moved down there that she moved up from, moved from Portland to Olympia.
And that's when you were going down there in summer of 67.
Yeah, it was after, I mean, she didn't show up until probably several months later.
Okay, so anyway, we got Geraldine Morris and Winston Turnbow and these other couples. Doobie, Robert Carr is not around from April 66 till spring 67, and that's the period that this Rai action happens around Doobie when he goes to Hawaii, and you've dropped out of it. And you're not involved with them in that period of the second half of 66, but you are going and checking out Krishnamurti. And
and Doobie dies in January of 67, right around the time of his birthday.
Yes.
And when I came back from seeing Krishnamurti, I practically had a nervous breakdown. I had to have a situation of quiescence, and I went to Vern's family. They gave me a room, and I stayed in that room mostly for a long time.
Is that in Everett? That's in Everett?
Yeah.
Where you are now.
And anyway, at one point, I was, like, carried away and was aware of something extraordinary. Well, apparently, this is when Doobie died. And when I later found out he'd passed, I went back and noticed the first day that happened, and so then I actively participated in. The way I figure is, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it says there's a 49-day period as the person goes. Well, I went with him, so to speak, for 19 days, and then I couldn't find him anymore. And then that was that, and it wasn't until around the time of my birthday that I started having some problems, and then I noticed that Chris was looking at the old readings, and I got pissed off at him.
The Organization of Awareness readings.
Yes. I said, well, now I know what's happening to me. It's like Chris's mind force. And then right after that, I got this letter from Geraldine Morse that got me to come down and do the first trance after all that. I'd done about 40 trances before while in the organization.
And that was got you to go down to Olympia?
Yes.
Okay. And Chris is Vern, just for the listeners. Chris Vern, interchangeable, same person.
Laverne Harold Christensen.
Okay.
Yeah.
But to end here, what's interesting, now you discuss the beginning of Geraldine bringing you into being a medium in the Paranoia Magazine full interview, which you can get on Paranoia Magazine's website. Or you can hear the audio at Dobstown.com in Section 1. Now, the interesting thing for me is that Bob goes to see Krishnamurti, but he runs into this strange character in, I think it's in Switzerland, who turns out to be Yuji Krishnamurti, who won't have anything to do with Krishnamurti, even though he was a longtime student of Jiddu Krishnamurti. And this Yuji meeting that he meets in late 66, years later in 79, he reconnects with Yuji Krishnamurti, Bob Carr and Connie do, and Yuji Krishnamurti had a cataclysm in 67. And that cataclysmic experience led to him mouthing off for the next...
What do you mean a cataclysm?
Yeah, spiritual collapse, a spiritual something, you know, a devastating spiritual experience. And he rejects everything. And he spends from 67 to almost... Yeah, he dies in 2007. So the next 40 years, he is ranting against the Rai principle, as I understand Rai, which is... something that sets up a priestcraft authority or awe, which leads to all wisdom and sages and teachers, that whole thing he spends knocking. So what the little interesting point, eccentric point I'm making, is that Bob Carr misses the technological fact of Rai returning to essence via Dubi, as explained by Dave Worster, but he meets the guru of the anti-Rai thing in that period.
And quite frankly, I think, I haven't looked into this guy and what he's ranting, but I think he's mostly ranting against theosophy.
Yes.
And you see all kinds of people in theosophy lorded it over Krishnamurti. You know, they loved him until he rejected them as significant. And so this guy had himself confused, as nearly as I can tell, of connecting Krishnamurti with all that, whereas Krishnamurti was not with the... So really, it's like he's not the anti-Krishnamurti as much as it is the anti-theosophy.
No.
Connection.
Hey, we will go into, that's what we'll start to clarify, because, no, he's against everybody. He's against India. He's against every religious tradition in the world. It's not just theosophy. He came out of theosophy. He's not anti-Krishnamurti on that level. He learned a lot from Krishnamurti. He just said Krishnamurti would not go all the way. And Yuji told Bob Carr...
All the way...
Yes.
According to him?
Yes, according to him.
Well, he was still in thought, though.
Well, yeah, but his whole teaching was not to be in thought.
But he's using thought to the hilt.
Well, to the hilt, did you say?
Yeah.
Well, that's where we're going to get into an interesting conversation between you and Bob Carr about this phenomenon, because Yuji, he told Bob Carr... that the old man, that was his term for Krishnamurti, the old man came and visited him at some point before Krishnamurti died and said, Yuji, and they were old friends, and some interesting stories Bob has, we'll go into later, about what happens in the relationship between Yuji and Jiddu Krishnamurti, but the old man, Yuji says, comes to him and says, you're going too far. You must tone it down for the people. The people can't take it as far as you can. And I guess Yuji was sort of, quote, boasting about how the old man tried to reel him in, but Yuji would not. So let's leave it at that point, Dave.
Well, now, I know that Krishnamurti told the follower just before he died, I think the last words he said is, well, you're a very nice person, and you're very wonderful, and all the rest of it, so on. But you just don't get it. And then he died.
Okay.
Now, whether it was Yuji or was it somebody else.
No, it wasn't Yuji. Yuji was involved very intensely with Krishnamurti at the moment he died, but they weren't in the, they were miles of thousands of miles apart. And that's an amazing story that Bob Carr witnessed. But we'll leave it at that.
He witnessed it.
Bob Carr.
He was there when UG died?
Bob Carr was with UG the night Jiddu Krishnamurti died.
Oh, okay.
It's a big, important part of the book. It's incredible. Okay, so let's leave it at that. I got to go. You got to go. The swimming pool is calling me. Life is calling you guys. So that's
okay. Listen to you. Listen to you.
The problem is you guys just don't get it.
So. Why don't you fart?
Yes, Old Farter Play, a great song by Captain Beefheart.
Let's go some of that gas.
Okay, that's it.
And when you do it in the pool, there's a joke about a guy who checked into a hotel, and as he goes and runs his bath water, the bellboy says, "Is there anything else?" And the guy doesn't say anything, but the bellboy thinks he does. So he goes down, he comes back up, and he brings him a bottle of Budweiser beer. And he says, "What? I didn't order this." He says, "Well, sir, I distinctly thought I heard you say, 'Boy, bring me a bottle of Budweiser beer,' which was the sound of a fart and the bubbles in the bath." So take your swim and fart.
Okay, thanks a lot for listening, whoever did listen.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll talk again, but you don't know when.
Well, I'll talk to you before the week. So we got to arrange this Bob Carr taping next weekend. I'm going to call Scott maybe later. Scott, that's it, okay, Scott?
Okay, Bob.
Okay, so I'll talk to you guys soon. I got
all right.
Off. I have family responsibilities here in Paradise. Okay, great performance, Dave. Thanks a lot.
Lots of light around you, and pass it on.
Okay, talk to you guys later.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.